We're a month away from testing in Bahrain. The F1 news keeps on coming as this offseason has certainly kept us on our toes. We've got all but one team's car launch date on the schedule. Helmet cams are here to stay. And will we see new F1 owners in the future? All this and more on Unlapped.
Should it get to a point where F1 is entertaining offers and is looking at, will they still have to get approval from the FIA? And then what will the FIA say about it? And what will the FIA's position be in it? And how much power will the FIA want to wield?
When do you decide to tweet from your personal account? And when do you decide to tweet from the FIA official account?
On one occasion, we had the superimposed shadow of an eagle flying over turn one at COTA, just midway through the race.
Katie George, back from a week off. Lawrence Edmondson, Nate Saunders, of course, as always. I missed you both. How was last week?
It was really good, actually. Yeah, we had a good podcast, but naturally missed you, Katie. And I know you were out having fun skiing, but obviously nothing's quite as fun as a podcast with us.
No, not at all. I did miss you guys, and the show is great. So I appreciate you guys holding it down in my absence. I also wanted to announce quickly that we will have a digital show at ESPN all throughout the season. Our first show is going to be on March 5th with Gary Streisky, Spencer Hall, and myself coming from Bristol, Connecticut, where our ESPN headquarters are. You two, of course, will be boots on the ground and a part of our coverage, but all season long, we'll have pre- and post-race coverage, which is really exciting. So something to mark on the calendars, ping in your iPhones or Androids. March 5th, first digital show from ESPN. And remember, if you're watching on YouTube, like this video, leave us a comment on what you want to hear more of. And don't forget to subscribe to ESPN for more F1 content. If you're listening, of course, hit us with a 5-star review wherever you get your podcasts. All right, let's dive in. So some news that is pretty intriguing, and I think there's a lot to unpack here. Saudi Arabia's sovereign wealth fund considered an attempt, we hear, to add Formula One motor racing to its growing portfolio of sports. Not really surprising because Saudi Arabia has been investing heavily in sports for a while now. We all know that, you know, it's in the Prem, bought Newcastle United FC. It's hosted major events in boxing, golf, and of course, F1. Lawrence, what did you make of this news? Were you at all surprised to hear that this was a possibility?
A little bit surprised, but like I said, it is in line with what Saudi Arabia has been doing in other sports. Perhaps the price tag was the most surprising bit and also the bit that seems to be debated a little bit. $20 billion was the number quoted, including debts. That's significant. Liberty Media, who currently own Formula One, bought it for $4.4 billion, about $8 billion, including debts, in 2017. So obviously the price of Formula One in that period seems to be escalating rapidly. And there's big questions about whether it's being overvalued, what that would mean for the sport if somebody did come in and try and buy it at $20 million and then try and make that investment work for them, and what it would mean for existing contracts, how much they'd have to go up. Races on the calendar. I mean, the amount of times we've talked on this podcast about races we don't want to lose from Formula One, but they're being priced out of the market for races, that would be significant as well. So it's a big deal. You look at where F1 is now, and I think it really does indicate just the success that Liberty's had with it, the amount of value they've been able to add to it. And there was a lot of low-hanging fruit. We know under Bernie Eccleston's rule, there was very little in the way of kind of social media usage, and there was no drive to survive. And we know how important those two things have been to growing the popularity of the sport in the United States, but all around the world, really. So it's no surprise, really, that companies, or in this case, countries, are looking at Formula One and thinking potentially there's an investment there that can work for it. But $20 billion is significant. I was looking up F1's annual revenues, and the most reliable recent figures from 2021, and that was $2.1 billion. So, you know, you're looking at kind of 10 times the annual revenue. Sure. And I'm not into investing, unfortunately. I don't trust myself putting any small amount of money into investments, let alone large amounts, but that seems like a lot. 10 times the annual revenue, and the profit from that year was 93 million, I think. So that's, you know, there's a lot, they would have to make a lot of changes, you feel, to regain that over time. But we'll have to wait and see. I mean, Saudi Arabia clearly interested in investing in different sports, and whether they'll go to F1, who knows? But of course, F1 has to agree to it. And the report suggested that there was no interest from Formula One to sell. So this story kind of, we're finding out about it about 12 months afterwards. And in fact, it seems like it was never really a major story to start with, because F1 never entertained the idea in the first place.
Yeah, it's wild, isn't it, that amount? But I'm not that surprised that so much money has been thrown out there. You know, this seems to be, if you look at just generally in sports now, the way power has kind of shifted from, it used to be, like, if we look in soccer, for example, it used to be Barcelona, Real Madrid, and a couple of Premier League clubs really had all the money. They were the teams that kind of dictated where the transfer market goes. That's now gone to kind of Qatar and now to Saudi. You know, the deal for Cristiano Ronaldo just after the World Cup was insane. You know, the money that he's being paid there, you know, to drop down in terms of, you know, standard of league, is basically the end of his kind of mainstream kind of career. So the power of that money is crazy. It's obviously completely changed the face of golf in the last year. WWE currently, I think it's about $6 billion that deal looks like it might be going to the Saudis for as well. So I think this is just kind of where we're at with sports now, sadly. Like, whether or not Formula One are entertaining this right now, I think it's clear that Saudi, you know, countries in the Middle East have looked at sports and looked at big events that we have, you know, across the world, and have said, if we can bring those here, they have the money, you know, and money often makes it a lot easier to put events on, to, you know, to get people on board with what you want to do. I mean, some of the, I forget exact numbers, but there was, and I'm not a huge golf fan, but some of the lower players down in the golfing kind of hierarchy said that they were being paid what their career would have been worth 10, 15, 20 times over, just to go play in LIV Golf.
Not even to win, just to play.
And like, it's easy to sit, you know, behind a desk and say, oh, well, you know, they shouldn't do it. But if anybody was offered that kind of money, whether you're a person, whether you're a business, you immediately look at it and you say, that's a, you know, it's a life changing, business changing, whatever, future changing amount of money. So I think that, you know, hopefully Formula One, you know, was serious about, you know, those reports said F1 didn't really entertain the offer, but it must have turned some heads. Anything that much money must turn some heads eventually. And like Lawrence said, Liberty have added to the value of Formula One. And I think that they probably were at some points looking and thinking, well, we could probably sell this for quite a bit more than we bought it for. You know, you never know 5-6 years down the line. Is that value going to tail off? Is it going to stabilize? Is it going to, you know, you never know. It could even ease off at some point. You know, this generation right now are obviously super popular, but what happens 5-10 years from now? So I'm sure that there'll be, you know, thoughts and stuff like that on what you actually do with this. But I'm fascinated to know what the teams think about this as well, just after we've been talking about, you know, they won't let Andretti in because they want to keep the prize fund as it is. You know, you imagine this amount of money coming into the sport, you know, the Andretti thing shows how important money is in terms of guiding key decisions. So yeah, it's definitely one we're gonna have to keep an eye on, because I think as well, you know, there's a reason this report would have come out now. You know, usually these things are either leaked or they, you know, maybe there's a formal bid being prepared, who knows. But yeah, that's crazy money. I mean, when I first saw it, I assumed there'd been a typo in the headline. I thought it must be someone's added a zero on there when they didn't need one. But yeah, it's wild. So I think this is kind of, sadly, I think in 5-10 years, I think most sports are going to have gone down this route.
Sure. Well, let me ask you this, Lawrence, back in 2017, when Liberty Media Corp made the deal, what did you think then of the valuation?
It seemed about right. So I believe CVC, the previous owners, bought it for, I'm just double checking my notes here, $2 billion in 2006. So, you know, it had gone up, but it hadn't gone up dramatically. And I think when Liberty bought it, I think a few people felt that they were, you know, they were paying a lot, but they really realized the potential in it. And that's the key, is that, can you find ways to make that money back? Can you find ways to increase revenue? Now, Liberty's been a bit unfortunate that within their relatively short ownership of the sport, there was the COVID pandemic, which really hit revenues hard. I think they made a loss in 2020. So it made sense that eventually it sold, and I think it was the right thing for the sport at the time. Bernie Ecclestone, who had really built the commercial side of the sport from next to nothing, kind of basically coming as one of the team owners into a position where he was negotiating with circuits and so on on the team's behalf, basically, and then eventually put himself into a position where he was able to get control of the commercial rights and on a lease and be able to exploit that financially. And so he built it to such a great level, but there were clear areas where Eccleston hadn't really explored or just didn't feel there was value in. But Liberty saw the value in those. And of course, that's similar things to what I mentioned in the last answer, the social media elements mm-hmm. and Drive to Survive and so on. So so Liberty have, you know, they made it work for themselves. So I think, you know, the price at the time, whenever a company gets bought for billions, you're always wondering, well, is that the right thing to do? But I think Liberty have shown with the way that they developed the sport and kind of managed to get return off it, increasing revenues. I imagine this 2022's revenue is going to be even higher and 2023 onwards. So, I feel like they paid a lot, but they're starting to get the money back. Now, the question is whether somebody then goes above that, like Saudi Arabia. But clearly, Liberty believe there's still a huge amount of work they want to do with the sport, a huge amount of profit they want to take from the sport. Otherwise, they would have turned around and perhaps entertained or at least got into negotiations with Saudi Arabia about selling F1.
We'll talk about a return on your investment, right? I mean, just the difference in the valuation possibly from 2017 to now, you could understand why this idea never even got off the ground, because they weren't in a position to even consider selling. I would imagine, Nate, that Saudi Arabia would consider making another offer in the future. Maybe that's the near future, maybe it's down the road. But if they were and the ownership changes, like, what would you think of a Saudi Arabian buyout? Would it change the way things are done, the way that we view the sport?
Yeah, I think it's a really good question, because I think ultimately that's what has to underpin this. I don't think this is the last we'll hear of this story. I mean, you just got to look at the other examples we have. I mean, the World Cup, I know it wasn't Saudi, but it was Qatar, and it had similar issues to what you might expect from, you know, Saudi ownership of something. Unbelievable in terms of the infrastructure that was built there at the World Cup, you know, as an event. Obviously, I mean, there was a graph going around, wasn't there, that it showed the money that was spent at World Cups before and then in Qatar, and just how much more money it was. Exactly the same with Saudi. I think the issue is, you know, you get into the kind of the murkier depths of some of the politics behind, you know, behind Saudi, and whether drivers, you know, right now Saudi doesn't own Formula One, but yet we've had, you know, we spoke about it on a pod a couple of weeks ago about the, and we're not exactly sure exactly what it looks like yet, but this clampdown on political speech and stuff like that. And one of the targets, you know, for you know, some of the protests that Lewis and Seb made in previous years was Saudi, you know, for a number of issues. So you start to worry about things like that. You know, does it, I think a lot of the time it comes back to this classic issue of sports washing, doesn't it? And that's the phrase that gets thrown around. And I think that Saudi, if you look at the other examples in other sports, they're very, very good. They're very, very smart at how they navigate a lot of those issues. They say, look, you know, we're here just to buy a sports league. We're not into politics, stuff like this. But I mean, the golf, some of those press conferences those players had before that tournament started were painful. You know, they were just kind of like, well, we're not going to talk about it. And it becomes the main story for a little bit. And I've always felt that the reason this has become a big thing and the reason it's successful is, and you saw it again, to use the World Cup as a kind of maybe a slightly clumsy but, you know, recent example, I think a lot of the Middle Eastern countries that, you know, are getting these events or getting these sports will almost ride out the bad publicity for a year, you know, 2 years, and then just get onto the business of running it. So in terms of Formula One, what it would mean, I think that would be the main concern, or one of the big concerns, is what does it mean from a political, social standpoint? Obviously, there's, you know, We Race is one, F1's trying to push inclusivity, diversity, stuff like that. But I think on a wider scale as well, you know, I think Lawrence alluded to it, you know, what does the schedule look like in future? You know, are Saudi going to really turn around and say, you know, Monaco, you can keep having the kind of sweetheart deal that you have currently? Are they going to look at, you know, races like Silverstone, stuff like that, and say, well, actually, we can get way more money, you know, a return on that investment that we've made from other places? So the sport, I think, would start to look drastically different to what it looks like now. You then include sponsors, you include probably, I would imagine you'd have at least one or two pay drivers from the region. And that's not to say you're not going to find good drivers from Saudi Arabia, but right now there's no obvious candidates who would, you know, would jump to F1. So there's all these things, you know, there's all these things that kind of come into play. So I think, and you kind of get elements of that every time you change leadership, but I think this is so complete, and it's such a wide ranging, you know, would be such a wide ranging takeover were it ever to happen, that I think if you were to kind of, I guess, itemize Formula One into every facet, everything that it is, I think it would impact everything, because it would have to, because the Saudis would come in and say, we want this to look like our sport. We want this to look like something we own and we control. And there's a lot of things right now that, you know, they would say, well, we want to change that, you know, and you can probably list those. I've mentioned some of them, but there's probably more I've not even thought about. So I think it would be big. And you can imagine the Saudis coming back with a different offer. Obviously, we're not in the room with those discussions, mm-hmm. but I think an interesting thing, if you're Liberty now, you look at it, if they were looking to sell, there's no other, you can't really see any other companies that would even be able to really match close to that. So I think that's also where that kind of money is interesting, is there's not really companies, you see some takeovers that are in that region, but they've really narrowed the market of other companies, other investors that could even come close to kind of matching that kind of offer. So it's almost kind of pushed the playing field, you know, so far away from a lot of people that might have been interested in becoming a stakeholder in Formula One.
Yeah, it's obviously a hypothetical at this point, but it's such a fascinating one to kind of dive into. Lawrence, do you think it's purely coincidence, or do you think that there's some kind of correlation between the FIA's recent ban of political statements and possibly this news coming out when it did?
I think it's really a coincidence. And actually, the FIA's stance on it, based on Mohammed bin Salem, the FIA president's tweets shortly after the news came out in the last couple of days, is that he's kind of warned against these inflated price tags. And he says, any potential buyer is advised to apply common sense, consider the greater good of the sport, and come with a clear, sustainable plan, not just a lot of money. Now, I don't think, you know, this is necessarily a political statement by Mohammed bin Salem. It's more just saying, look, we can't get carried away with how much this sport's worth. And I think a lot of the concerns, as he lays out, the future impact on promoters in terms of increased hosting fees and other commercial costs and any adverse impact. So again, it's really just whoever comes in and pays 20 billion, what are they going to do to try and recoup that cost, and how they do it? So I honestly don't think that the restrictions, we shouldn't really call it a ban, because potentially drivers can still protest if they get sign off from the FIA. I don't think that is necessarily related, although of course the FIA were probably aware of this bid or may have got wind of it because it happened last year. But I think an interesting thing in all of this is the FIA's role in the ownership of Formula One. Mm-hmm. Where it stands, what rights it has, and its relevance going forward in Formula One, because we discussed that, we've alluded to it on a number of occasions, because there seems to be increasingly battlegrounds being drawn between the FIA and Formula One. The most obvious recent one was the Andretti entry, which the FIA seems to be very much behind, and Formula One is a little bit more lukewarm on, and whether Andretti Cadillac will come in 2026. To do a bit of a history lesson into the ownership of Formula One and why this is actually very complicated, is that the commercial rights that the Formula One group hold or Formula One management hold are on a 100-year lease from the FIA from 2010 to 2110. So essentially, you actually get this kind of ownership structure quite a lot. In the UK housing market, you have leaseholds, which, you know, you don't necessarily own the ground on which the building's built, but you have the lease for 100 years or so on.
I'm sat in a leasehold right now, lads, so that's a great...
There you go.
I own the flat, but I don't own the building.
I mean, but for all intents and purposes, you own that building, right? I mean, you can do with it what you want. You can knock walls through, assuming you get planning permissions and so on. So it's the same thing. You know, F1 owns the commercial rights and they will make money off them. But... There is this kind of contract in place, this lease in place, and this was a hugely controversial deal. It remains to be a hugely controversial deal because it was sold by the previous FIA president Max Mosley to Bernie Eccleston for somewhere between $300 and $360 million at the time. Now that's for 100 years of exploitation of the commercial rights. So clearly, Formula One's made its money back already on the money that it paid the FIA, plus more and more and more. And now we're talking about it being sold for 20 billion. So, you know, when we talk about why is the FIA still relevant, well, technically, due to this lease, they still actually own Formula One and the commercial rights. But one of the reasons that lease existed in the first place was the European government essentially decided that they wanted to split for monopoly reasons the commercial rights and the running of the sporting side. And so that's where Moseley and Eccleston came to this agreement and it was moved on. So yes, it's very complicated. The other thing is whether the FIA would have any say over who buys Formula One and for how much. Okay. They had to approve the Liberty Media buyout in 2017. And it's interesting that Mohammed Ben Salem would be so vocal at this stage. I mean, like I said, we don't think F1 is about to be sold. F1 declined the offer, it seems, or didn't get into talks with Saudi Arabia. But should it get to a point where F1 is entertaining offers and is looking at, will they still have to get approval from the FIA? And then what will the FIA say about it? And what will the FIA's position be in it? And how much power will the FIA want to wield to, make sure its own position within Formula One is certain going forward? So it does become very political, but I think, you know, some of the smaller things and some of the things which get a lot of traction are not necessarily the main drivers. That there's a lot going on underneath. And it will be interesting to see how it plays out and to try and stay on top of it. And yeah, I just this afternoon was looking back at some of the history of it to kind of refresh my memory of how Formula One and Bernie Eccleston ended up with such an amazing deal on this 100-year lease of commercial rights. But yeah, it's interesting stuff.
Take me down that path, though, because I think at face value, you would assume, okay, Liberty just has to agree to sell and then just we'll make all this money and be gone. But a couple entities have to approve of this, right? They all have to be on the same page to make this happen.
Yeah, so my understanding is the FIA do. I found a Liberty Media investment prospectus that talked about the 100-year lease and that that it was necessary for the FIA to sign it off. But it said there were exceptions, but it doesn't detail what the exceptions are. And I haven't seen the 100-year lease, so I couldn't tell you exactly. But maybe there is a way around it. And I think a lot of it will depend on lawyers getting in a room and deciding. But it would be very unusual for the FIA to stand in the way. F1 shares in F1 have changed hands a number of occasions since basically the late 90s through to Liberty's buyout of the controlling shares in 2017. Lots of different owners have come in and out, and the FIA have never blocked any of them, as far as I'm aware. I wasn't working directly in the sport in the early 2000s, and so I don't know exactly, but I'm pretty sure that they've never blocked something like that. And a lot of the time it was Bernie Eccleston working to basically ensure that there was investment in the sport, but also ensure that he retained control. And then for a long period of that time, his good buddy Max Moseley, the head of the FIA, kind of working with him and making sure that they both had a backbone of power that they could make sure they could still make the decisions. But of course, that all changed in 2017 for Bernie when he was kicked out by Liberty Media. So it's a different world now, and I think there's a lot more regulation as well on these kind of deals than perhaps there was in the past.
If you're the FIA president, when do you decide to tweet from your personal account and when do you decide to tweet from the FIA official account?
Well, that's a very good question. And in fact, the question of whether Mohammed Ben Salem should be talking about this at all has also been raised by Formula One in a letter from their lawyers to the FIA. That's how serious the situation has got, to bring it completely up to date, is that F1, in a private letter, although it was leaked via BBC and Sky News, questioned really why Mohammed Ben Salem was talking about the value of Formula One in public. Of course, as I mentioned before, that 100-year lease means that the FIA looks after regulatory affairs and the sporting side,
and Formula One looks after the commercial rights and how to exploit them. And of course, the value of that side of the company is a very sensitive issue for Liberty Media. I mean, they may not be looking to sell, but at some point, perhaps they may do. And to have the FIA president saying on an exact date via a medium as public as Twitter that the sport is not worth $20 billion, that it's been overvalued, is significant. And in this letter, which, like I said, has been published in a number of places, the F1 lawyers said that the FIA president had overstepped the bounds of both the FIA's remit and its contractual rights. It does seem like Mohammed Ben Salem picked a questionable one here. Of course, he says that he's acting in the interests of the sport. As custodians, the FIA have an interest in doing so. But Formula One feels that is going too far. You know, to start talking about the value of their business is going too far. And in the letter, they went as far as saying, to the degree that these comments damage the value of Liberty Media Corporation, the FIA may be liable as a result. So it was a punchy one. Like I said, private letter from lawyers to the FIA, but still one that became public and one that is very clear in its intent, which is to help to tell Mohammed Ben Salem to back off and not get involved in Formula One's commercial affairs. So where do we go from here? Well, you know, that's kind of the interesting bit. We're not quite sure. Neither F1 or the FIA have commented publicly on this from their heads of media. So we'll have to wait and see what maybe some people think. We'll wait for those launches, see if it becomes a topic there. I suspect it will be, and into testing and the racing. Of course, when the racing gets underway, we all like to talk about that. But this is going to be a theme throughout 2023 and perhaps beyond, this battleground, this constant warring between F1 and the FIA and where it ends and also where it leaves the sport. And also, what are the reasons? And I suspect underneath all of it, it's mainly financial. So, yeah, it's something that we'll keep an eye on, and I'm sure we will discuss many times again on this podcast.
It's kind of fascinating, isn't it, when you peel back some of the layers of this? I think it goes back to what we were talking about with Andretti, what we've talked about kind of increasingly over the past, 12 months, definitely. Obviously, since Ben Salem came in at the start of last year, he kind of came in at probably the worst time you could come in as an FIA president, right after Abu Dhabi 21. But yeah, we've had there's this simmering kind of tension beneath the surface. And I've always felt that, we've talked about it before, that it does feel like the FIA president is more and more kind of loggerheads with Stefano Domenicali. There was that crazy exchange he had with Horner on stage at the awards giving ceremony. And it all feels a bit like I don't want to say ego involved, but there's definitely a desire to, where there must be a desire for him to kind of stamp his authority on motorsport. I think if you Lawrence has mentioned one of the names, but if you look at the two people that preceded Mohammed Ben Salem, you had Max Mosley, who, in terms of motorsport was, as heavyweight as they come. He and Bernie were such a great pairing together in terms of what they're able to achieve together. Then you have Jean Todt, who was a juggernaut in his own right, who had achieved so much in Formula One, was revered for what he had done in Formula One. And you've got Ben Salem's coming. I've always felt that there's been, I don't want to say people have looked down on him because he's head of the governing body, but I don't think his reputation carries the same weight as a Todt, as a Mosley. Okay. And I don't know, maybe it plays into that. Maybe it's a desire for him to, I don't want to say he wants to stand alone from the governing body because he's in charge of it, but I think it's just a way of reinforcing that he's the guy in charge of that governing body. Because I thought that was strange. Usually you'd put that out in an official press release. You'd put that out and say, this is the official statement. Here's what the president says. So very strange. And it'll be fascinating. I mean, annoyingly, we won't get to talk to any of the team bosses for, a couple of weeks. We'll obviously be talking to Christian Horner and then to Toto Wolff the following week when launch week starts. And I'm sure those two guys will have a really fascinating opinion on that. But, Horner was the guy on stage with him at that ceremony. I think there is a feeling that there's kind of a, I don't want to say there's a peculiar way of handling things, but he definitely goes about things in a very different way to what Formula One is used to. And it has rubbed some people the wrong way. So it'll be interesting to see how that tweet and how that reaction is perceived within F1. Maybe not the contents of it, but maybe the way he went about actually putting it out there, because it, you know, what he said actually made a lot of sense. But like you said, Katie, he kind of, yeah, tweeting it from your own account, it just, in this day and age, it just looks a bit, it just doesn't look,
looks off.
I don't know. Yeah, it doesn't look proper, does it? For want of a better phrase. So I did notice that. I thought it was strange. And who knows, maybe, you know, the story coming out and maybe his response is all part of this, you know, this deeper issue that we see where, you know, there's some things going on behind the scenes where, as exactly, I mean, what Lawrence was saying there, you know, half of that stuff, I was kind of having to remind myself. There's a great documentary on, well, there's two actually out. There's one on Max Mosley and there's one that's just come out on Bernie Eccleston, which details a lot of this stuff. And it is amazing just how detailed it is. But yeah, the great thing that F1 and the FIA used to have was that those two guys got along. They weren't always on the same page, but they knew how to work with each other. And I think that that's been lost with Ben Sulliam coming in. And I think that you're starting to see those cracks more and more, whether it's Andretti, whether it's, you know, some of the things around sprint racing, etc. So yeah, like I said, interesting to see how all of this has been received.
We'll close the book on this for now. We might revisit it depending on what happens in the future, but I want to talk a little tech. Passion, drive, and patience. What brings home the winning trophy is also what keeps your ride or die alive. eBay Motors has everything you need to maintain your vehicle and level it up to peak performance. From superchargers, roof racks, exhaust kits, LED headlights, and more. Whether you're into speed, power, or style, eBay Motors has got you covered. With over 122 million parts for your number one ride or die, you'll always find exactly what you're looking for. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, your part is guaranteed to fit your ride every time or your money back. Because with eBay Motors, you're burning rubber, not cash. With all the parts you need at the prices you want, it's easy to turn your car into the MVP and bring home that win. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.
Tired of ads interrupting your favorite sports podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music, included with your Prime membership. Amazon Music offers the most ad-free top podcasts. Enjoy shows like First Take, Pardon the Interruption, and The Low Post, available ad-free and uninterrupted. To start listening, download the Amazon Music app or go to amazon.com/ESPNpods. That's amazon.com/ESPNpods to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Something that's been in the works for a while now is helmet cams, and apparently they are here to stay. After specific trials that we saw throughout last season, the FIA believes that the new tech adds value during broadcasts, and fans and viewers, you know, seem to agree. So the use of helmet cams in 2023 and beyond was proposed, and apparently it was unanimously approved to update the 2023 technical regulations. So we will see this as we get going this season. Thoughts on how it, like, seems kind of like a no-brainer to me, Lawrence, but what do you make of the helmet cams? You a fan?
Yeah, I think it's one of the coolest things we've seen in terms of a development in the final product of Formula One that comes onto your screen at home. Mm-hmm. I think it's one of the coolest things we've seen in ages, you know, perhaps as far back as, you know, the original onboard cameras or some of the changes in views we got from onboard cameras. So it really does give you a different perspective for a number of reasons. One, just because you're that little bit lower in the cockpit, the viewpoint out. And so it's that little bit closer to what a driver has. For years, we've got used to what we call the T-cams, which are the cameras on top of the roll hoop on the top of the car. And you get this kind of view over the front wheels and you see a lot more. But what you always had to remember is that the driver is sat lower than that. And really, they can't see beyond the tops of their two front wheels. And so, yeah, to get an idea of what that's like. And then also sometimes the violence of the movement within the car. And I'm not talking about an accident. So I'm just talking in one G-forces in corners. But then also last year, one thing that we talked about an awful lot was the porpoising of the cars, the bouncing of the cars up and down due to basically aerodynamic sensitivities and how much you could see that through the helmet cam. Now, the human eyeball was incredible in that it is actually able to adjust for a huge amount of vibrations and weird movements and your vision stays fairly steady. But the helmet cam technology is kind of moving on as well. So you get an idea of the vibrations and everything, but all those movements you see, even if the driver's eyeballs are able to compensate for some of it, is all in the kind of violence, the sheer forces jarring. Going through the cars. Yeah, the, you know, how jarring it is to be a Formula One driver. So I think it's fantastic. And we kind of got really used to seeing it being used in footage last year. You know, we got some glimpses of it, I think, a couple of years ago, and slowly they've been rolling it out. So now to make sure that it's on all drivers' helmets going into the new year is fantastic, because it means every incident, every overtaking maneuver, all of it will be captured. And while you might not see it live through that, they're more likely to use it as a replay. Mm-hmm. That's such a cool perspective, I think.
Yeah, and it's I think it's really important as well for taking the fan into moments where, you know, for example, when it rains, those T-cams, often it doesn't quite show you just how much, how little visibility there is in the car because of the placement of that. It's actually, you know, a lot of the water being dispersed is kind of, is being dispersed in a very different way around that camera than it is around the driver. So I think that things like that are super. I mean, I absolutely loved it. Same, I think most people who saw that thought it was incredible. And Lawrence is right. You know, so if you see the old 80s footage of Senna and Prost, the cameras are bouncing around and they're, and I mean, it, you know, it's kind of helped by their, you know, sometimes they're manually changing gears as well in the car, but that bouncing, I mean, some of those onboards in the Senna documentary are just unbelievable. You know, he's going around Monaco and it's the cameras bouncing around. It's fine. And it just adds something visceral to the experience when you're watching it now. And it's, you know, the cameras are fantastic, but it doesn't quite give you that same thrill watching it. So I think that's what the helmet camera does. And I think as well, it just goes to show you how limited that visibility is in the cockpit. You know, you see a lot of this now. I always go back to Lewis v. Max at Silverstone. The amount of people I saw on Reddit and Twitter and TikTok and everything after that, kind of almost like it was like the Zapruder film from, you know, the Kennedy assassination, like frame by frame looking at it, like, you know, Verstappen moves a slight bit here and here. But you see it through someone's T-cam, that's one thing. You see it through their visor cam, you realize just how minute these things are and just how quickly they happen. And also, you know, the visibility in those mirrors isn't, you know, it's not great. So it just hammers home again just how amazing it is that Formula One drivers do what they do. And yeah, I mean, last year, I forget the first one we saw last year, but there was one where we're all in the media center and there was sort of people, you know, people who've been covering it for 20, 30 years who were like, wow, like this is so cool. So I think it has that ability to get people, even who have been watching it for decades, kind of out of their seats and think this is amazing. So from a visual perspective, that's always great.
Yeah, I think for a long time there was a desire to get some kind of helmet cam in there, because in the 90s, lots of cameras started to sprout on the cars in different places. Mm-hmm. There's one by the front wing and rearward looking ones and things like that. And I think the technology got a lot more reliable, so they could run it into live transmission. And the Senna documentary is a really good example of some incredible, incredible footage. But it wasn't always used in the live stuff. And in fact, I think the makers of the Senna documentary were amazed when they went to Biggin Hill, which is where all the previous reels of film or digitalized video from all those previous years is kept. And they were allowed to go through it all, and they just found this amazing stuff, which is why I think, you know, that documentary is still spectacular, even for someone who watched all of those races, you know, because you do get to see something very special. One thing which I really loved, and it wasn't actually to do with the onboard racing, but was for a very brief period, they broadcast the driver's briefings, or at least little snippets from it. And it was when it was pre-Michael Massey, so it was when Charlie Whiting was still the race director. And just seeing, above all, I think, Charlie's relationship with the drivers and the level of respect they had with him, and also the jokes that they would occasionally have. So I can't remember exactly when it was, but it must have been, I'm guessing, around maybe 2016, 17-ish. They had, these little kind of, like, snippets of just drivers joking with each other or laughing at each other or asking ridiculous questions to Charlie. And F1 used to put it up on their social media, and a lot of it still floats around now on social media.
There's a gif of Perez, isn't there, that still comes up from that, where exactly, I forget what happened. Yeah, I think he and Grosjean had an incident, and Grosjean basically just rats him out at this driver's briefing. He puts his hand up and says, we're going to talk about what Perez did, and it shows Perez, and he's just like, you know, just like a kid that's just been told off at school. So that was great. And it's a shame they got rid of that, really. But imagine if we'd had that in 2021, just some of the, you know, some of the stuff. Yeah.
What people want. Yeah. That's interesting.
Well, and also, so it sounds like we're trying to sell the Senna movie to people listening, but in that movie, you have incredible stuff in the driver's briefings where Senna is going at it with the FIA president then, and, you know, he's got Prost there, and it's got, you can see, like, which drivers are kind of on his side and which aren't. So I think stuff like that, I think that's what Netflix has shown. There's a real market for that kind of thing. It's probably the only thing now that isn't public now in Formula One, if you think about the amount we see, the amount we get access to. And I think there's an element of that, isn't there, that F1 and the teams have probably realized, you know, if you think about Saudi last year is probably a great example where they were having those meetings. Imagine if we'd seen what had been said in those, you know, how much kind of damage control F1 would have had to do. But yeah, I love those as well.
I can't believe you guys forgot the most important invention in F1. And that's for the Skyglass customers. It's the red button. Come on.
Oh, yeah.
The greatest invention so far in Formula 1.
Yeah. That's true. Well, the sky glass I thought was just such an obvious one. We didn't want to say it. Yeah, I've never used sky glass, so I don't know if it's as good as the adverts make out. But
what's next? What do you think will be the next technological advancement or addition to broadcast? What do you want to see?
One they're already experimenting with, although I've yet to be convinced by, but I think has huge potential, is drones. So of course, most of the aerial footage of races is from a helicopter.
Mm-hmm.
And actually, when you're at the track, watching the helicopter in itself is sometimes more entertaining than watching the race, because it's banking low, it's coming up over trees tracing cars around the track. So that's great. But the potential for drones is very high. But at the moment, they've only really had them running on kind of bits of the infield for obvious reasons, because if they fall out of the sky and onto the track, you've got an issue. So they've never quite been able to get over the cars or as close to the cars as you would hope. And as you often see in promotional videos and kind of GoPro's own promotional videos, but the teams have done it occasionally. So they have what they call filming days, which is when they get all their filming to share with their sponsors and all of that kind of stuff and all the photographs they need for the year. And they get a couple of those a year. And a few of those, they've taken drones out and flown them over cars as they go around parts of the circuit. And it looks incredible. So if you can find, and this may never be possible, but if you can find a drone that's reliable enough to kind of fly just 2 or 3 meters above the cars as they go into the first corner, that would be sensational. But I don't know if we'll ever get there. I don't really know what the limitations are on drones. Sure, some listeners will know much better than I do and why that's impossible. But I think that would be fantastic to see.
You know, they say air traffic controllers have the most stressful like jobs of anybody. And I don't know, do you call them drone flyers or do you call them drone drivers? Whatever the terminology is, like, I couldn't imagine the stress, because some of these people, I mean, you see these promotions, these commercials that are all done by drone footage. They're incredible. Like the nooks and crannies that they're flying, like you've seen like the stadiums that they showcase, like new openings of, let's take you through this new stadium or new arena. The way that they can fly these things is unbelievable, but I couldn't imagine the stress if you were taxed with, hey, we're going to have you be our drone flyer driver for an F1 Grand Prix. That would be, I couldn't.
Can you imagine one falls on the track and they're like, we have to red flag the race.
No, and it's on you.
Can you imagine that? And you're the guy, like there's no coming back from that. So one thing they do seem to have gone away from a bit more, they used to be really hot on these, I used to love them, was the little cameras that would sit inside the corners. So you'd have cars going over them. You still see them occasionally, but there was an era when I think that Formula One was just obsessed with them. And like every race you'd have, every lap, it'd be like, no, 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 no. And they'd all be coming through the corners. And it would just be great because you'd see how fast they were going. And they don't seem to do that so much now. I'm not sure if there's a reason behind that. But I used to love those. So I don't know whether, maybe they're just considered a bit too old school now. There's so many new innovations you can have. But I used to love those. Those used to look fantastic.
They do still have them.
They do. Maybe they're less spectacular now. That might be the other thing. Maybe I notice them less.
I think there's like a slight reluctance because you have no idea what's going on. So somebody could be over to you. Just see like
that's two, true.
Like, one red flash that's a Ferrari and one silver flash that's a Mercedes, and that's your lot. But I think they occasionally use them. But I know they definitely still exist because on one of the, I think it was a Thursday, so a media day for us at the French Grand Prix, and I was sat in the press room and we have all the TVs up there which show us the race, obviously, when the race is on. But at those times of the weekend, they're just showing stock camera footage. So sometimes you get a view down the pit straight or whatever. Anyway, but one got stuck on one of these curve cams, and you can see all these people doing what we call like a track run, which is when you try and stay fit at a Formula One race and you run around the track a couple of times. And you see all these people like panting in like 30 degree heat in France trying to do it. So they definitely still exist, because I remember sending a picture of one to somebody who was doing a track run. And I saw them on it, but yeah, but not used so often. You're right. And I think there is, this stuff really goes through trends, doesn't it? Like real trends of thing, one thing or another. And one thing which I really didn't like was when F1 was superimposing either messages, or on one occasion we had the superimposed shadow of an eagle flying over turn one at COTA just midway through the race. And I think it was kind of end of the Bernie era. And like, I think they were like, right, what can we do? We must do something new and innovative in TV. How can we do it? And to try and detract from the fact that some of the racing had got really quite dull. And so they started flying imaginary eagles over turn one, which I don't really want to have returns for more.
10 seconds on the clock. How many things can you name that are always growing? Your relationships, your skills, your customer base. How about businesses on Shopify? Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage, to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage, Shopify's there to help you grow. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/network, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/network now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. shopify.com/network.
Hi, this is ESPN's Mike Greenberg, and ESPN Bet is ready to take you through all the biggest sports moments this spring. The official sports book of ESPN has exclusive offers and markets from Scott Van Pelt, Stephen A. Smith, and me. From the upcoming draft, the playoff intensity, and finally getting out to the ballpark, there's no better time for sports fans. Sign up today, and new users get $100 in bonus bets for making any sports book bet. Download ESPN Bet today. What a play.
Must be 21 plus and present in select states. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Terms and conditions apply. See app for details.
Speaking of COTA, there was one, it wasn't really an F1 innovation at COTA, but it was one that definitely should be brought in for just the humor. I don't know if you watched this race, Katie, or if you can remember it, but there was, I think it was 17 or 18. It was one of the first ones I did at COTA as a journalist. And you could hear somebody on the mic going, meow, 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 like that. And he'd found a mic somewhere and he was doing the car sounds. And to his credit, David Croft, when he's doing the world feed, says, oh, there's somebody, you know, has found, yeah, he's kind of laughing it off a little bit, but it was fantastic. And then he'd taken he'd filmed himself doing it as well. And I always thought that was great because, you know,
who was it? So just a random.
I think it was a random, I think maybe he was working at the circuit or something, but, I don't think the race was the most exciting one either, or maybe it was a lull in the race or something like that, but that one always sticks out. Maybe you couldn't do that every week, before, you know, get annoying very quickly, but for maybe a dull race, you put someone next to a microphone and say, do your best car impression.
Bro, see how when that goes he down. Started the sounds to when he was found, how long transpired?
Oh, a few days because it was shown on the broadcast and then it was kind of laughed at, and I think there was a few more where you could hear it, and then the video emerged of him doing it a day or two later, and he's doing it with this big grin on his face, he's kind of laughing as he does it, so I can't remember the guy's name. I don't know actually what happened to that guy, so you know, on the off chance he's listening to this pod, please do get in touch. I loved it.
Well,
but yeah,
he on.
Yeah. I mean, he can do some sounds for us, and we can, you know, use them for transitions and stuff like that.
That's incredible. Oh, there are worse names to have, by the way.
Yeah, definitely.
He should take that. Couple updates real quick. We've been telling you about car reveals and the certain dates of those launches. Alfa Romeo has announced that February 7th is their date for their car launch. The last remaining team that we are awaiting is Haas. What do we know? What are we expecting just from what they've done in the past, Nate?
Yeah, so Haas, they tend to follow a blueprint. You know, they don't go all out really with the car launch. You know, often we get a kind of an email, you know, a press release with, you know, a car image in it, with the livery, and we don't actually usually see the real thing until the morning of testing, which is, you know, I think that they like to just, you know, go for the kind of the no frills approach. But what's interesting is the one year they went all out with it was 2018 or 19. I forget the year they had Rich Energy. It was 2019. And that's obviously the year that the title sponsorship completely fell apart by mid-year. And they had this really nice event at the Royal Automobile Club in London. We all got dressed up. We, you know, they had the new livery. It looked like the old Lotus car. And so I think that that experience, if Haas were ever going to lean back towards going towards doing launches, I think the memory of that event has kind of maybe, you know, made them think twice about it. Because obviously this year they've got a new title sponsor to replace Eurocarly from a few years ago in MoneyGram. So we haven't heard of an official launch. They may well do something, but it's very out of character for them to do that. But I kind of like that. They're kind of the guys that just, they'll throw in a press release and say, here's the car. And I think they were the first team to show us a 22 car, if I remember rightly. They just kind of dropped an email and said, here's what it looks like. And I think you get, for a team like Haas, it's quite good. You get a bit of a buzz. You can generate your own kind of hype around that. You know, maybe you own a day or you own 2 days of the kind of the craziness in silly season. But that's what we're expecting. And I think things might look a little different on that car next year in terms of color, livery, just with the new guys coming in.
Good tease. Maybe we'll have more information next week. As always, I appreciate you both. Thank you so much for your analysis. That's it for us on Unlapped. Remember, if you're watching on YouTube, like our video, leave us a comment, and subscribe to ESPN for more F1 content. And if you're listening, hit us with a 5-star review wherever you get your podcasts. Nate Lawrence, thanks so much. Cheers.